A few years back, History of the Saints began production of 7 seasons of a documentary television series titled History of the Saints. Season 1, Foundations of the Restoration. Season 2, Joseph Smith's Kirtland. Season 3, From Pentecost to Persecution, The Missouri Years. And Season 4, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. Then 3 more seasons telling the story of Brigham Young and the Saints, beginning with the Nauvoo Exodus in 1846, titled Gathering to the West. Then Building Zion. And finally, The Kingdom Endures. Altogether, over 100 hours of Latter-day Saint pioneer history. For these and all of History of the Saints books and DVD products, visit us at historyofthesaints.org.
Welcome to the History of the Saints podcast. My name is Glenn Rawson, series host. What you are about to listen to is an episode about the documentary history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This episode is one of more than 250 presentations from 1805 and the birth of Joseph Smith the prophet through 1877 and the death of Brigham Young. This series interviews some of the finest scholars of our time and presents the latest in historical research and facts as it relates to early Latter-day Saint history. And it comes from the long-running, highly acclaimed television documentary series, History of the Saints. If you have a desire to learn the history in depth and detail, then this podcast is for you. Thank you for joining us.
The average print run of any book published in America in the early 19th century was about 1,000 to 2,000 copies. When Joseph Smith desired to have the Book of Mormon published, he signed the contract, made the agreement to publish 5,000 copies of the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith was highly ambitious in his publication plans.
June the 11th, 1829, the copyright of the Book of Mormon had been obtained. Joseph, from the very beginning, wanted to print the Book of Mormon. He intended to print 5,000 copies of a book with more than 500 pages bound in leather. Now, by anyone's standard on frontier America, that was expensive and a daunting undertaking for any printer. So then the question, who was going to do it?
There's an important context of the coming forth and printing of the Book of Mormon that we need to remember. The United States was a fairly new country still. 1830, we have the second generation after the Revolutionary War that they're building the country. They're exploring the West. They're building up markets, transportation, communication, all these explosions of improving their lives. The Book of Mormon comes forth in that context. There's an explosion of literacy of citizens in the United States. The literacy of that country is remarkable considering other countries at the same time. There's also an important explosion of print technology.
As they were nearing the completion of the manuscript, they're of course becoming more and more concerned about how are we going to publish this? But the Book of Mormon itself had reaffirmed in its text, as they translated it, that Joseph was going to be the means of bringing forth these words to the world. That's a pretty daunting task. How is he going to bring forth these words to the world? The world? I'm a penniless farm boy. I had to borrow money to buy the home that I have. How in the world is it going to be brought forth? The first place they go, at least by the accounts we have, is to Egbert Grandin. They go to Grandin's print shop in Palmyra in June, at least according to some accounts, June of 1829, and they try to convince him to do it. Grandin has a fairly large new press, right? He has the capability to do it, but he thoroughly refuses.
Mr. Grandin at once expressed his disinclination to entertain the proposal to print at any price, believing the whole affair to be a wicked imposture and an attempt to defraud Mr. Harris, who was his friend, and whom he advised accordingly. Pomeroy Tucker.
We often think Grandin said, oh, no, I don't know how that would ever make any money, and so I'm not going to do it. In fact, he seems to have a close enough relationship with Martin Harris that he's very personally concerned for Martin Harris. Look, to do this, it's going to cost thousands of dollars, and you're going to lose your whole farm, and those books are not going to sell. And so he apparently actually goes to Martin Harris's friends and tries to get his friends to convince him to not pay for the Book of Mormon. So he doesn't just say no, he actually builds animosity and opposition to the plates in Palmyra. And so faced with that, you know, Joseph and Martin, they need to go somewhere else to find a printer.
There was another printer in Palmyra, and of course they approached him as well.
Contact was made by Jonathan A. Hadley, who was the editor of the Palmyra Freeman. It's another. There are two primary newspapers in Palmyra at that time, and one was Egbert B. Grandin's Wayne Sentinel, and the other was the Palmyra Freeman. And Hadley looked at their proposition and he said no.
Of course, Hadley thinks this is ridiculous. He makes fun of it, he mocks it and says, what a great strange thing it would be that some illiterate farm boy in this little town just so happened to be chosen by God to go find some ancient plates written in hieroglyphics and have the power to translate. And he's very sarcastic about it, which is with the reaction many people have. So most likely what happened is they went and they talked to Hadley at the Palmyra Freeman, and they said, can you publish the Book of Mormon? And Hadley probably said, you've got to be kidding me. I barely got this press running as it is. I can't publish a 500 plus page book. And how many copies? 5,000 copies? No, thank you. But you know who might be able to do it? My master who taught me in Rochester, Thurlow Weed. And so Joseph and Martin go up to Rochester and they meet with Thurlow Weed. Eventually is going to become one of the major power brokers in the Whig Party and then eventually in the Republican Party. He is the primary backer, the handler almost, of William Seward, and is the one who runs William Seward's campaign for president in 1860 when the Republican Party in convention decides on Abraham Lincoln as a compromise instead of William Seward. Thurlow Weed is going to become a very, very powerful politician. And every time he gives an account of his meeting with Joseph Smith and Martin Harris, a reader has to know that it's in the context of Mormons are very thoroughly hated. So by the accounts that Thurlow Weed gives of the visit of Joseph Smith and Martin Harris, Joseph comes and tries to persuade Weed to publish his book. Probably comes and says, look, I talked with Jonathan Hadley. And Weed gives several reasons why he doesn't want to do it. You know, first, of course, that Mormonism's, you know, it's a delusion and it's an imposter and it's, you know, it's silly. But probably more at the time, he was probably concerned, like all printers are, about, well, is this book even going to sell?
I thought the man either craved or very shallow imposter, and therefore declined to become a publisher, thus depriving myself of whatever notoriety might have been achieved by having my name imprinted upon the title page of the first Mormon Bible, Thurlow Weed.
Thurlow Weed said that he was visited by a smooth faced young man with an odd occupation, and he decided that he did not want to publish it. But Joseph was still determined, and Martin Harris came back with him. And Martin Harris assured him that he would be security for it.
He came again, accompanied by Martin Harris, a substantial farmer residing near Palmyra, who had adopted the Mormon faith and who offered to become security for the expense of printing. But again, I declined. Thurlow Weed.
And we're probably glad that Weed said no, because he gets tied up with politics in Albany that very year and probably would have been an absentee printer.
Thurlow Weed directed them to another printer there in Rochester, a man by the name of Elihu Marshall.
Now, Elihu Marshall is a much more well-known printer. Elihu Marshall has published books before, and in fact, his spelling book, published in 1819, is essentially the standard teaching book, at least in that part of the country, to teach spelling to students. Oliver Cowdery may have used it for all we know. It was for sale in Jonathan Hadley's print shop in Palmyra, so he at least knew about it, even if he didn't have it himself. And Marshall was a Hicksite Quaker, and maybe that made him more open to what Joseph and Martin Harris had to say. The Quakers already were considered on the fringe of American Christianity by many people. They considered them to have beliefs that sometimes weren't entirely in line with the standard Christian theology. And so he's someone who not only has said, I don't believe everything there is to know is in the Bible, he's also said, I don't believe everything there is to know is in religion today. And so when the pitch comes to him, when they go to meet with him, you can see why he might have been more intrigued with this. The idea that God is speaking to men again, that there is more revelation, and the things he might have heard from Joseph and Martin might have been more attractive to him. We don't know the nature of what they talked about, except that we know that Marshall agreed to do it and that he was going to do it. We don't know the terms, but that he was going to do it.
But before they said finally to Elihu, you're our man, they did get back to E.B. Grandin once again and said, the book is going to be published, and we would rather do it with you because you're 2 miles from our home.
And really, the problem was logistics. Rochester's far away. It can be more than a day's journey, depending on how you're traveling, from Palmyra. They want to keep a very close, tight hold on the pages of the manuscript. You could see why after the 116 pages episode, that they want to keep a tight hold on the manuscript. They don't want to just, oh, here you go, here's all of the pages and do whatever you want. They want to be a part of the printing process. And if they're going to do it in Rochester, well, now they've got to pay for room and board. Now they're even farther away from where Joseph is because Joseph is still down in Harmony. It's just easier if it's in Palmyra.
In the meantime, the colleagues of Grandin convinced him that it was not him that was doing the work other than the printing, that Joseph Smith was the author and proprietor of this work, and that it was a business deal.
They come back and they say, Marshall's going to do it if you aren't. We'd rather do it here, but it's going to happen either way. Harris is going to lose his farm either way, right? He's going to pay for it either way.
It was upon this statement of the facts and in this view of the case that Mr. Grandin, on taking the advice of several discreet, fair-minded neighbors, finally reconsidered his course of policy and entered into contract for the printing and binding of 5,000 copies of the Book of Mormon at the price of $3,000, taking Harris's bond and mortgage offered in security payment. Pomeroy Tucker.
And so they agree to 5,000 copies for $3,000, which is just an enormous sum. And to give you an idea, Joseph had bought his farm and his house in Harmony for $200. The publication of the Book of Mormon was going to cost $3,000, 15 times what his house and farm cost. Another way of thinking about it, the average ditch digger day laborer in New York made $1 a day, which means, given the days you're allowed to work, you make around $300 a year. It would have taken Joseph 10 years of not spending a dime to earn $3,000 to pay for the printing of the Book of Mormon. It's an enormous sum. It's not something that he or Hiram or his family ever could have done. And the only way that it could have been paid for is with the help of Martin Harris. The fact that Martin Harris mortgaged his farm to pay for it is the only way that it could have been paid for. And so he's essential in that. But I think we sometimes forget how much money. $3,000 today, yeah, is a lot of money, I guess. But it's a sum that someone, most working people, would never, ever acquire. And no matter how hard they tried.
Unfortunately, this agreement between Martin Harris and Egbert Grandin ended the marriage of Martin Harris. His wife, Lucy, remained bitterly opposed to Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon.
A few years back, History of the Saints began production of 7 seasons of a documentary television series titled History of the Saints. Season 1, Foundations of the Restoration. Season 2, Joseph Smith's Kirtland. Season 3, From Pentecost to Persecution, The Missouri Years. And Season 4, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. Then, 3 more seasons telling the story of Brigham Young and the Saints, beginning with the Nauvoo Exodus in 1846, titled Gathering to the West. Then, Building Zion. And finally, The Kingdom Endures. Altogether, over 100 hours of Latter-day Saint pioneer history. For these and all of History of the Saints books and DVD products, visit us at historyofthesaints.org.
As we've mentioned in the past, Joseph Smith was only 24 years old when the Book of Mormon was printing, and Egbert Grandin, he was only 23.
E.B. Grandin had come down from Pulteneyville, which is 22 miles north, when he was a teenager and apprenticed himself to Pomeroy Tucker. And Pomeroy Tucker had a business partner who was John Gilbert. Pomeroy Tucker was publishing the Wayne Sentinel, and they were in the Jenner block initially, but they moved into a new location, which had just been completed in 1828, and it was called the Thayer and Grandin Row. It's Joel and Levi Thayer and Philip Grandin, who is the brother of E.B. Grandin. And so Philip Grandin is renting to his own brother. And it's an 85-foot-long block of four bays, business bays. And E.B. Grandin occupied the West Bay, today at 219 East Main Street. And he had his bookstore in the Lower Bay. He had gone into partnership with Luther Howard on the second story where the bookbindery was, and Luther Howard was the binder. And on the top floor, there were two parts. Thomas Baldwin, a law officer out front on Main Street, but behind that was the print shop of E.B. Grandin. So you could print them, bind them, and sell them out the bottom.
In July 1829, Oliver Cowdery began making a second copy of the manuscript of the Book of Mormon, called the Printer's Manuscript. Joseph had learned by sad experience to be very careful with sacred texts.
A revelation came to Joseph commanding him to see that Oliver transcribed the whole work a second time and never take both transcripts to the office, but leave one and carry the other so that in case one was destroyed, the other would be left. Lucy Mack Smith.
We're not going to take in the original. We don't want to lose the original. We're going to make a copy. And so they will make copy as they need copy and try to keep ahead of the printer.
This is very profound, especially for historians today, because the original manuscript, although not stolen or lost in Grandin's office, was eventually mostly destroyed by the elements as it was stored in the cornerstone of the Nauvoo House in Nauvoo. And so the fact that the printer's manuscript exists, the fact that Cowdery made that copy, gives us the closest thing we have to the original text in a complete form, because so much of the original Book of Mormon manuscript is now lost. So they begin making this copy, and that's what Cowdery's engaged in. He and Hiram and Martin are kind of overseeing the publication in Palmyra. Meanwhile, Joseph Smith is in Harmony, Pennsylvania, and they're carrying on correspondence via letter.
Now, in addition to this, they were instructed to take only a few pages at a time to Grandin's print shop, and that with a guard. Peter Whitmer Jr. and others were appointed as guards over the manuscripts of the Book of Mormon day and night.
$3,000 is a lot of money, and it was a very large consignment, 5,000 copies in that day. They were printing maybe 500 copies, where you didn't have composition rollers and a small press, or even the larger presses were not putting out anything like that in terms of an edition. And so that $3,000 loomed large, and in the finality, A.B. Grandin agreed that he should do that work.
We're talking about a very good living would be around $500 a year. So if you were to kind of put that in today's standards, the cost of printing the Book of Mormon is, you know, around $300,000 probably. I mean, it's an enormous sum for a poor farmer and his friends to be able to figure out how they're going to pay for it.
If we think about this, Joseph Smith published the Book of Mormon before the church was even founded, before they even had members of the church. They didn't reach 1,000 members until years after the publication. For Joseph Smith to want to publish 5,000 copies of the Book of Mormon just boggles the mind. It is really remarkable. That number, 5,000, helps us understand the reaction Grandin had to the number. 5,000 copies printed that could have been done easily in New York City or other fairly large urban areas. But for Palmyra, to be fair, it was a growing city, but it didn't have the resources to publish that many books. And so we understand why Grandin was hesitant, why he demanded the payment up front, why he was concerned. But Joseph Smith's optimism, likely driven by his spiritual manifestations, he knew that the church was going to go somewhere. He undertook this remarkable publishing endeavor.
And of course, with an undertaking as ambitious as this, Grandin was going to need some help.
Just a thought in regard to the crew of E.B. Grandin. Pomeroy Tucker, who had sold him the paper, Pomeroy Tucker was the shop foreman. John H. Gilbert was the compositor. He set the type and did the press work. Jacob H. Bortles, the press work. Tom McCauley, or Whistling Tom, did the press work. William Van Kamp, the compositor. Daniel Hendrick read proof and set type. Franklin P. Rogers, who was a relative of Harriet Rogers Grandin, the wife of Grandin, was an assistant.
And so sometime in August of 1829, Hiram Smith brought the first 24 pages of the printer's manuscript to Grandin, and the printing of the Book of Mormon began. It would not be completed until March of 1830, about 7 months later, and the binding of the Book of Mormon sometime after that. When we come back, part two of the printing of the Book of Mormon, the misadventures of Obadiah Dogberry, and more. I'm Glenn Rawson, and we'll see you then. Thank you for listening. If you would like more information on what you have listened to, please go to historyofthesaints.org. The History of the Saints team that produced this podcast has also produced numerous books and full-length documentaries on early Latter-day Saint church history and the key figures that made that history. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast of History of the Saints has been produced by Dennis Lyman and Glenn Rawson. History of the Saints is a 501c3 nonprofit organization.